Hello, everybody. Welcome once again to Stepping Out Radio, as we like to call it, Stepping Out Radio. This is where you're going to hear things that you usually don't hear on the radio. These are stories of addiction, stories of recovery. This is reality radio at its finest. I'm Scott Clark. Thanks for joining us, and we want to give a shout-out to Armed Forces Radio because we broadcast from our studios here in New York, all across the country, but we also go across the world, around the world, on Armed Forces Radio. And we thank our sailors and our soldiers for listening in, but most importantly, for being there for us and keeping us safe. We're going to welcome in Alex on this day. Hello, Alex.
What's up, Scotty? How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Alex is a gentleman who lived with his addiction to alcohol, drugs. I say alcohol and other drugs because alcohol is a drug in my book, and just about any other doctor, if they're worth their weight in salt, will tell you it's a drug. And Alex, we begin at the beginning. This is your story. What's your beginning?
First of all, thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
And you're 100% correct. Even though alcohol wasn't my vice, always got me going in the wrong direction. So no two ways around that. Very similar to the speaker before from the standpoint of my mother and dad divorced at a young age. And I came from a wonderful family. My mom and my aunt, who's my mother's twin, grew up, they live right next door to each other. So I grew up with two mothers. Couldn't have a more loving, caring family. My aunt's husband, my Uncle Richie, he's a counselor. And I grew up with three parents. But my earliest memories growing up are of my father not being there. You know, waiting on the steps and waiting to go to a baseball game and my dad not showing up. And it's funny because he wasn't part of my life. He's an alcoholic, by the way. And my grandfather also was an alcoholic. And that's why my mom divorced my dad. She didn't want me to grow up in that environment. But those inconsistencies, till to this day, my dad just passed away, which is something I'll talk about, that was really emotional for me to deal with. These inconsistencies, even to today, it's just, you know, that affected me to my core. And had a lot to do with how I dealt with things, my identity issues, you know, not feeling good enough. You know, more what I am instead of who I am. And that had nothing to do with the upbringing that I had, because you couldn't come from a more caring, compassionate family, but it couldn't make up for the fact that my dad wasn't there. And I didn't know that early on. I just know I felt different, or I felt less than, or I was embarrassed maybe because my mom was a single parent. I grew up in a North Jersey suburb, a lot of money. My mom worked, she's a nurse, night shift, two jobs, sent me to Catholic school, the best schools. But, you know, my mom worked nights. The others had two parent families, and they had a normal life. I had to get someone to pick me up to take me to basketball because my mom's sleeping. No one else had to do that. Financial aspect, we lived well, but maybe not in comparison to some others. Mm-hmm. So I always was in that comparison facet, and there was a lot of identity issues growing up. And I think later on, that led me towards abuse.
Why is it that we all who are addicts always compared, didn't relate, always compared, better than, less than, better than, less than, better right. than, less than? Is that where you were at?
Absolutely. And I didn't know it back then. Now, because I've been given the gift of recovery therapy, as was mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. yeah, you're able to identify those things. But early on, they were just feelings.
And some did feel that they were either better than or less than in a particular situation. Others felt that they were just less than no matter what. How did you feel?
You know what? Who I was a great person. Like I said, I came from a wonderful family. I was a good kid. Even through high school, I barely touched drinking or drugs. Never touched drugs until college. Looked down upon people that did it. So I did feel less than. I just, you know, but looking back, it's like, well, I'm a good person. Like today, I'm a good person. It's just for whatever reason, there was that identity. And I think a lot of it has to do with my father. And now knowing that's the disease of alcohol, you talk alcoholism, addiction, that's collateral damage. I mean, not only did it affect him, but the effect it had on me, it took me away from a whole side of my family that I barely knew. And, you know, my dad was very inconsistent in my life. Now, to my mother's credit, she never blamed him. She always says, your dad's sick. He has an illness. One day you'll understand. One day I did understand, but it was tough. And my mom did the best she could. Maybe back then I did need some therapy or some counseling to deal with it. But when you're young and growing up, you know, it's tough to identify these things.
But she did recognize that he had a drinking problem, and she said that he was sick, which is more than what most would say at that time.
Well, she should have slammed
many
him.
Many years ago. But she didn't. Now, you say, though, that she did not enable him, that she did leave. She
yeah,
did
my mom
you.
Is a single parent, divorced my dad when I was 2 years old. Mm-hmm. We had to go live with, that's another thing, we had to go live with my aunt and uncle for a while, which, again, you're different.
Mm-hmm.
Looking back now, those are all badges of honor. Like, what my mother did for me to help me, to put me in the best schools, to give me the best life, to work night shifts so she could be there when I get off school. Forms of embarrassment, maybe, or feeling different, are now like, I am so proud. Because the sacrifices that that woman made, my family made, my aunt, my uncle, I just didn't see it back then.
Youth is wasted on the young.
Right.
Let's just put it out there.
Right.
I mean, we never really appreciate
right.
our parents
right.
until we're older.
Right.
And the older we get, the more we right. do appreciate them for the good things that they did for us. And maybe then we also understand what a little bit better why a person who didn't do so many good right. things for me did what they did. When did you have your first drink? How did that happen?
You know, pretty much.
You said it was drugs, but it was yeah. was what was your first? Was it drinking?
Yeah,
or was it
high school. You know, I would say a little bit of drinking. Nothing really that stood out. And for the most part, because I was always aware of the dangers of alcoholism
mm-hmm.
through my father.
Right.
So high school, there was no drug use, a little drinking. When I got to college is when I start to go down that slippery slope. And again, I was looking for some sort of identity. And the identity I found are the ones that are dealing marijuana, the ones that are involved with drugs, because that seemed cool to me.
Mm.
Now I had some sort of identity. Like I remember I tried out for soccer, a walk-on, Syracuse freshman. I went to Syracuse University my freshman year. I didn't make the team. I told everyone back home and stuff that I made the team because I didn't feel good enough for who I was.
Right.
So I had to make something else up. And so eventually I got into people in the dorms and stuff, smoking pot. Marijuana became my vice.
Now, you had said at that time, you said, I will never be like my father. I will never drink like my
right.
father. But pot was another way. You didn't really put the two together.
I didn't put the two together. I didn't know
pot
that.
Pot was different.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I knew, okay, to stay away from drinking and the dangers drinking can cause. I didn't see the correlation that addiction's addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to get me regardless.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in the genes. My grandfather died from it. My father died from it. And you know what? I was on that course too. I didn't see that. And I found marijuana. And marijuana was great. I loved it. I functioned on it. I did well in school on it. I was social on it. I felt cool on it. Drinking was never my thing. But then again, a lot of times it would be a few drinks that got me going in that direction.
Right.
So I can't excuse that fact. Say, oh, I didn't have a drinking problem. You put a few drinks in me and I'm in the ghetto in 5 seconds.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's no two ways around it. So
take the pot away. Yeah, yeah. I'll take the drink then. Take the drink away. I'll take the Coke. Take the Coke away. What do you got?
Right. So pot for a long time became my friend and a consistent. I never thought I was addicted because physically you don't go through those feelings, but I smoked it every single day of my life. And I fully believe now that it was a gateway that allowed me to go down other roads. I would have fought you tooth and nail on that.
Mm-hmm.
What's wrong smoking pot? What do you mean? I'm doing this, that. It's not affecting me. But putting that chemical day in and day out into my body, you know what? Really allowed me, I think, down the road, knocked my defense mechanisms down. And also, long before I physically became addicted, I crossed that line. Abuse behavior was dictating my behaviors, you know, as far as my responsibilities or my work or whatever. It had me on a course long before I was physically addicted. Mentally was driving the bus long before.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and that's the power. You know, they talk about that cunningness. You can't see it. So
it was pot and it was more pot. And did that progress then? Did you graduate from pot to other drugs or did you just stay with pot for the most
yeah,
part?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much college. And up through my beginning part of Atlanta, after college, I graduated. I moved to Atlanta to go work for CNN. My first job out of school, my cousin works for CNN, got me a job in journalism. That's like getting it on a silver platter. And you get an opportunity to start at CNN. I would say it was experimental with other things. You know, I was open to it. Cocaine with some buddies, ecstasy, acid, whatever, shrooms. And the thing I remember about cocaine, it was probably the first time I did it, is I want it more. And now at that time it was, I want it more. Next thing I'm up for 5 days, but I remember everyone else going to sleep, whatever. And I want it more. You know, I remember that. And it had me, you know, and I didn't see it back then. And for a long period of time, it was just very recreational and casual on the weekends. I was able to draw that line of partying and responsibility. You know, it just didn't get blurred to the end where it was just all partying and responsibility went in the toilet bowl. You know, so for a long time, I was able to balance the two. And I would call myself, besides being a consistent marijuana smoker every day, a recreational drug user.
Mm-hmm.
Going out to the bars, getting some drinks, you know, going if someone has whatever, you know, doing things like that. But for the most part, you know what, it was still, hey, if I had responsibilities, you know, I was going to do that too. So definitely recreational weekend warrior type thing.
We justify it so many ways.
Right.
You know, it's, well, I smoke pot every day, but I work hard, I play hard. I work hard, I play hard. And I'm a recreational drug user, but I smoke pot every day.
Right.
But it's all recreational.
Yep.
And where did that take you?
It took me, like I said, when I moved down to Atlanta, it was very similar. You know, the marijuana all day. You know, I mentioned when we were off air, you know, I got fired from my first job at CNN. I was about 6-8 months in, and, you know, I decided to go to Jazz Fest and not getting my shift properly covered. Now, I couldn't tie this into drug abuse or anything because there weren't the signs. But it was, again, it was my behaviors. A responsible person gets a brand any job. You're supposed to be at work. You're at work. And there was,
well, they wouldn't have pot at Jazz Fest, would
right.
they? Not in a million right. years, right?
So absolutely not. That's about as sober of an environment. Right up there with Mardi Gras. Two of the more sober environments you could probably attend. So it was influencing my decisions, like I said, long before I
So did you go to Jazz Fest?
Yep.
We'll talk about that when we come back. We're talking with and speaking with Alex, and this is Stepping Out Radio. Scott Clark with you. Thanks for joining us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Stepping Out Radio, True Stories of Addiction and Recovery. I'm Scott Clark. Thank you for joining us. We're talking with Alex about his use of marijuana and other drugs. And if you think you may have a problem with marijuana or drinking or other drugs, or if you think you have a problem and you think you might need to get some help, go to our website. That's a first step, www.12stepmeeting.com. That's www.12stepmeeting.com. When you're there, you can sign up for our free newsletter or drop us a line. We'd love to hear from you. www.12stepmeeting.com. Alex, heading for Jazz Fest. Got the gig going, CNN, first thing out of college. Your bright star.
Yeah.
And Jazz Fest, and what happened?
Yeah, I mean, you know, pretty much the gist of that was, you know, that led me to losing my job at CNN. And one of the common themes for me is the parachute is always opened again. You know, I've always had a soft landing. I've been in a skew of legal trouble. I mean, arrested a ton of times. But the parachute's always open. I've always gotten out of it in some capacity, lost jobs. The parachute's always open. I get fired from CNN. The parachute opens. I happen to land a job at Fox Sports in Atlanta.
What happened to Jazz Fest? What happened that you got to Jazz Fest and lost your job?
Well, what happened was, is, you know, the thing is, you would get people to cover for you. You wouldn't go through the normal chains of command and put in for a vacation. I'd ask Shep, if he was working there, hey, you want to cover my shift? I'll cover you. And the guy that I asked to cover for me, he didn't show up, you know. And so, therefore, he's not supposed to be at work. It's supposed to be me. CNN's a big company. A lot of times, they don't really know who's working where, as long as, you know, there's not a void. So that was pretty much it. You know, not being responsible, saying, hey, I'm going to put in for time off, a vacation day like everyone else does. Hey, you want to cover for me? I'll cover for you down the road. So it seemed innocent enough in nature. And oh, my bad luck. The guy didn't show up. He screwed me. Right. Instead of the other way of, you know what? Hey, maybe I should have been more responsible in my approach. And if I couldn't get the day off, guess what? You don't go to Jazz Fest. You know, that's just the reality of life. You don't need to bend the rules and break the rules. But like I said, I got fired, and within a short period of time, I got a job at Fox Sports. Mm-hmm. And I love sports. So it was actually better, you know, and it was a phenomenal thing. And I was there for quite a long time. I had a great run, about 7 years, from 97 to 2000, beginning of 2004, when I finally had to come back home. And, you know, because I had just run my course there. You know, at the end, it was just, I was an absolute mess. So, yeah, the parachute has always opened for me. Might not open next time, Scott.
Well, what happened during those 7 years at Fox as far as your disease was concerned, your addiction?
Yeah. I mean, everything else for, I would say, the majority of time, my actual addiction period, where I would say, like, I was physically hooked, like, I couldn't put it down, was really short-lived. And thank God. For a good period of time, it was just, again, pretty much casual use. I mean, yeah, the marijuana smoking was every day. And, of course, it's all rationalization now. You know, on the weekends, you know, sometimes maybe you get around people that are doing coke or whatever. But, again, it was always weekends, whatever. And it never really started to bleed into, hey, my Saturday, Sunday. Next thing, it's Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. You know, that came later on. And same thing. You know, I tried crack a few times. I don't know when's the first time I tried it. You know, I think someone probably said, hey, you know, we're at a party, want to try some of this? Sure, why not? But that was the drug. When I first started to get that, that was the drug. And when I did that, I couldn't stop.
When did you start doing that?
I would say probably, you know, midway through my time at Fox, you know. But again, I was able to, when I did it, it was maybe for like a night into the next day, but I was able to stop, pass out, and then I wouldn't do it again for a month or 2 months or whatever. You know, so it was still more, there's nothing experimental about crack, but it was still more in the experimental stage as far as just once in a while. The other thing, too, is, you know, not to get too graphic, but we never really smoked it out of the, you know, the glass stems that you use. Mm-hmm. We'd more have concoctions of like plastic bottles and stuff. So I don't think I was really getting the potency of it all. I remember it had to be probably 2003, the beginning of 2003. I was doing it once. I was getting it from a dealer. And first of all, you know you're a good customer when you have street dealers willing to give you credit. You know, later on, too. Not many street dealers are willing to allow you to run up thousands of dollars of credit and, oh, he'll pay me down the road. I remember a dealer once said, you know what, hey, how do you smoke this? I'm like, I can track the concoct a bottle and all this. He goes, why don't you try this stem? And I'd really never smoked out of a stem before. But I'll tell you, one of the most vivid memories of my addiction, when I used that stem, it was like beam me up, blast me off. It was like Pookie on New Jack City. It was a whole different experience. And I think really from that point on, it had me. You know, I was progressing. And then once it got me, forget it, man.
That's when you got the full hit.
That's when I got the full hit. I couldn't put it down. And not only that, you know what? That became my priority. You know, the way I look at addiction wants me on an island all by myself. It wants to blow up every road back to the mainland, my career, my spirituality, my family, my friends. And it was doing that. I lived in the upstairs portion of the house. I was happy just being up there, a prisoner in my own room, the happiest person. And, you know, that's the progression a little later on, but that's what it wanted me, man. It wanted me all by myself with my drugs on that island by myself. Let's blow up all the bridges to the mainland.
So you're doing the crack now, and you're doing it on a more regular basis.
Yep.
Daily?
Yeah, you know what? It's starting to get to that point in Atlanta. It's the progression is definitely starting to pick up. Like I said, you know what? My weekend, say, you know, TV's different industry. You know, say I'd have a Monday, Tuesday off. You know, I'd start when I get off work Sunday night, and next thing I'll just do it for a few hours. Next thing it's Monday afternoon. You know what? Most people, hey, let's go to time to go to bed. You know, it's been 12 hours. No, I'll do it Tuesday, into Tuesday. I got to be to work tomorrow. Okay, I'll stop now. But then, no, I'll keep doing it. And next thing, I've been up for 2 days straight, and I'm whacked by my mind going into work. Mm-hmm. And next thing, you start doing it at work. And that's where you're starting about like, wow, you're spiraling out, but you don't see it. You know, and anyway, I had a phenomenal run at Fox. Same thing. I ended up getting fired, you know, from being someone that always got, you know, noticed for good work, promotions, you know, given things as far as, hey, we're going to reward our good employees, to the end was I was getting written up like, what's wrong? You know, your work is slacking. You know, we're starting to see things, you know, and then excuses are coming in, whatever, you know, oh, there's nothing wrong justifying. To one day, I remember I had to be at work at like 10 in the morning. And I just overslept. And next thing, it's like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And, you know, where's Alex? Alex is passed out. They don't know where Alex is. I used to have to set 4 or 5 alarms just to try to wake up because I wouldn't hear any of them. And the only time I ever fell asleep is if I just passed out. It wasn't because I was going to put down the drug. And I'm like, sorry, we got to let you go.
That was the final straw.
At Fox, yeah, at Fox. But the parachute opened again. I got even a better job. I got a job working on a reality NASCAR show in Atlanta. But what they didn't know...
Stumbling forward.
Yeah. But what they didn't know was the fact that they got a hurricane. They got that job got a Category 5 hurricane. And I remember when I got fired from Fox, this was, you know, talk about the guest before, the weight of the world coming off your shoulders. I remember, like, I had to call my mom. I had to talk to my uncle, who's a counselor, and say, hey, I have a problem. I need help. That was one of the toughest phone calls. That probably kept me out another 3 or 4 months.
We'll see what happened when he went to the next, stumbled forward to the next job. To NASCAR reality, we're with Alex on Stepping Out. This is Scott Clark. Thanks for joining us. We'll be right back. Welcome back once again to Stepping Out Radio. Scott Clark with you. Thank you for joining us. We're listening to and talking with Alex, colleague of mine in the business, who was, he had to have been pretty good, man, to have these jobs, to be fired from these jobs, but then continue to stumble forward, as we talked about before, from CNN to Fox Sports, to being fired from both for not showing up, to now... stumbling forward to NASCAR reality show. And what happened there, Alex?
Well, and you're absolutely correct. Before I got this, you know, before I got the next job, my friends, who were all partiers like me, you know, they had an intervention on me. I remember they brought me down to my living room, and I had been up for days. And at this point, it was days, you know, $300-$400 a day, up for days. Where am I getting this money? You know, that's another issue. The stealing from the parents, the stealing from the roommate. I mean, you know, that's a whole other can of worms. You
are we back at Fox here at this point?
Yeah, this is when I got fired.
Okay. And who did the intervention?
Well, I had a roommate, a friend from college, Thea, and she was concerned.
But you were whacked.
I was in a different.
You stood out above the rest.
A different stratosphere. And I remember all my friends got around me for an intervention. And like, you know, you need help. Oh, yeah, no problem. You know, just again, yeah, yesing them to death. And, you know, but looking back, I mean, yeah, there were serious issues. And then that was shortly before me getting fired from Fox. I remember Thea telling me, I got fired in the end of January, New Year's Eve. She's like, you need to go to rehab. And I'm like, oh, no, I don't think I need to go to rehab. She goes, you're going to end up in some sort of trouble. You need to go to rehab. That's the first time I started hearing the word rehab. Mm-hmm. And I've been through a few rehabs. Mm-hmm. I didn't get it right away. Anyway, so I get fired from Fox, and that's when now the cat's starting to get out of the bag. It's not my little dark secret anymore. Now, the thing about being in Atlanta, too, because my family's from up here, is I was able to keep them immune from a lot of this because they didn't see me on a daily basis. And if no one's telling them, well, you want to know what then? It's only what they're getting from me.
And your resume is moving up, though. You're going up, up, and up.
Yeah,
CNN,
I'm able.
To Fox Sports to... You're their pride and joy, probably, right?
Yeah, but getting fired from Fox, that's the first time it had to come out of the bag. And when it comes out of the bag, your gig's up. You can continue to try to do it, but it's done. Because when other people start to know, that's when you really have to isolate if you want to be part of your addiction, because no one else is going to support it. And I remember having to call my mom, and it was one of the most emotional phone calls. But it was the weight of the world. You hear about this, it's true. It was like, my mom's like, okay, you know what? We're going to help you. Help. To raise my hand and say, I need help. Today, it's the easiest thing. Back then, I couldn't get it up. But once you get that hand up, it's amazing. It's like, wow, there's people that will help me. And my uncle, who's a counselor, drug and alcohol counselor, said, you want to know what? I'm going to get you in a rehab in Atlanta. Outpatient. Now, again, I diminish my, oh, I only use it a little bit, Uncle Rich. Right. I wasn't truthful yet. So I go to rehab and I get about a 2-month program outpatient. I get sober, but they're telling me things like you need to go to AA. oh, sure, I need to go to AA. Stay away from bar, people, places, and things, old friends. I can go to the bar and drink, you know, tonic or, you know, and have a ginger ale. Maybe I can even smoke a little pot still, right?
And just for those, Alex, who talk about going to from outpatient therapy and those to go to inpatient therapy, which do you recommend?
Well, I'll tell you, at the end, what finally got me was an extensive outpatient, but I think it's just where you are in your realization of your addiction. Because I went away, too. I went away to an inpatient program in Pennsylvania, and it was great. I mean, can they send me to rehab right now? It's a vacation. I'd love to go back to rehab. It's the best time of my life. You're getting healthy. You're in a cocoon from everything else. So I just think it's where you are in the process of your realization. Mm-hmm. For me, it was a progression. I'll tell you something. Thank God for my uncle, because my family is unconditional in their support. A lot maybe say they enable, you know, but I needed them. If they ever cut that cord, I was gone. I needed them to stick with me. And my uncle kept saying, it's a progression. He might fall down, but if he gets back up and tries again. And I did have those. Anyway, I got clean, feeling good about myself, lose 15, 20 pounds. You get a girl, not listen to any suggestions, whatever. And I happened to get a job with the Reality NASCAR show. And I'll never forget this. I was about a few weeks in, and I remember one night I got off work because my weekend. I want to treat myself. You know what? I can do this one more time. I heard a lot in my first rehab, you got to say goodbye to your drug. Now, I had up to a $400 or $500 a day crack habit. And somehow I had in my mind, I never said goodbye to my drug.
Uh-huh.
So I remember I called my dealer and I said, you know what, hey, can you meet me, blah, blah, blah. She was so happy to hear from me, by the way. Where have you been? Oh, no. I mean, you know. And they all names like Baby or Poppy or, I mean, you know what, you know.
That is going home.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember I got the, now this is again, I'm doing well. I have a few months under my belt. I'm feeling good. Not realizing the severity of the addiction, you know. And I remember getting the drugs and I remember looking in the mirror and saying, you know what? It's just going to be this once. I'll say goodbye and that's it. 6 months later, I'm in a rehab. And it just picked right back up. And the severity of it was like a category 3 to a category 5. And you want to know what? That weekend I was up all. Guess who shows up late to work at the NASCAR show? I do. Oh, I overslept, whatever. You know, they don't know my history. So these seem like definitely decent excuses. To next thing, I'm bringing drugs there. And this was at a small little production house, you know, and I'm sneaking in the basement. I'm doing drugs. Now, my boss, Ned, I had no loyalty to him. He should have cut the cord instantaneously. I was with that job for about 6 months, and it was hell on my employers.
This is the insidiousness of addiction. This is Alex's story. This is Steppin' Out Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back once again to Steppin' Out Radio. Scott Clark with you. Thank you for joining us, and thank you, Alex, for joining us as well. Alex has been taking that long road of addiction down to, it took us to the NASCAR reality show and showing up late and now in the throes of cocaine addiction and crack. And what happened?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in it now. I mean, I can't get out of it. And there's that helpless feeling, too. I remember, talking to my uncle. And, you know, they had known at this point, because a lot of my friends had notified him, too. Hey, he has a problem. We want to let you know the severity. Because it's one thing, me, I'm telling him I'm doing casual cocaine. You still let him know, no, he really has a severe problem. And he's like, just go to AA, you know, just go get some more help. I couldn't. At that point, I needed to get away. I couldn't remove myself away from the drugs. I mean, and I was a mess at work. And I remember making excuse after excuse. I mean, the excuses that you make up, right? Looking back now, I mean, you're ashamed of yourself. And it's just an absolute mess of my time there and how disruptive I was on what they were trying to do as far as putting a show together. But
you know, my grandmother died 4 times in college.
It's It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
So it now we're in August of '04, and you know at this point the gig's up, and you know my boss is like, you know, you really need to go get some help. I mean, this is, and I'm like, I know.
And you know you're lying. You know you can feel the humiliation and the remorse at this time, or are you just trying to save your job? What is your mindset at this point?
At this point, I don't know if I was ready to surrender because clearly I went back out again, but I was ready for a break. That's what it was. I mean, I don't know about any other addiction, you know, pot or alcohol. I mean, they're all the same. But crack just destroyed me. I mean, you're up for days. We're talking 4, 5, 6 days at a time. You're exhausted. You can't do it, but you can't put it down. And the minute you wake back up, you go right back to it, and you're trying to exist in life. There's no existing in life. If you want to do crack, you're going to sit in a room by yourself, and that's what you're going to do. So trying to exist in life, it's impossible. It's exhausting. So finally, I called my uncle and I said, "Uncle Rich, I need help. I need to go away," you know. And he said, "We'll get you on a flight tomorrow." You know, a buddy of mine runs a rehab center up in Pennsylvania, Clearbrook, and we'll send you up there. And the next day, I was on a flight. Now, here's the thing: I remember, you know, again, I wanted to just do that one last time before I go get my flight. My flight was like at 8 a.m. Missed that flight. Missed the next flight. The last flight out of Atlanta was like at 11 p.m. that night. They didn't think I was going to get on the flight because I couldn't stop doing it. I'm doing it in the cab ride, going to the airport. I'm a mess. I'd been up for days. I couldn't put the drug down. I remember I put some in my suitcase because I wanted to take it with me, you know, do some back at home. Think about this. I'm going to rehab, and next thing they're going to find crack in my suitcase. Like, you know, I'm trying to get help. And the amount of crack I was carrying wasn't just like a little, no crack's a little slap on the wrist.
All right.
But the amount I got, you know, if they get it, you're a serious offender. You're going to go away for a while.
And what's a cabbie saying when you're smoking crack in the back seat?
Funny thing is, he asked me for some.
Oh.
He asked me for some. I did it with him. He asked me for some. He said, "Can you leave me some?" He said, "You don't even have to pay the tab." So I get to Newark. It's like 1, 2 in the morning. They physically have to shake me on the airplane because I'm passed out cold. You know, I remember the attendant like shaking me, like, "It's been 5 minutes since I've been trying to wake you up," because I was out. And I remember when I got to the carousel, my suitcases weren't there. And I was like, "Oh my God." I kept praying. You know, it's funny how you find God. "God, please, I hope they didn't find my suitcases. Just let me get these suitcases. I'm going to rehab tomorrow, please." And I see the suitcases over in the corner. Because I got into the carousel so late they had moved them. But I'm thinking they put them there, and the minute I go to grab them and identify them,
no, so, paranoia or anything.
Absolutely not. No. So I asked my uncle, "Hey, can you go get my suitcases?"
Oh, God, you put your uncle to it, huh?
I wasn't even. Anyway, I get the suitcases. You know, it was just they moved them there, not for the purpose of the identified drugs. That night I passed out. Next afternoon I'm supposed to go to rehab, and I'm like, you know what, just let me do a little more. I disappear for like 3-4 hours. And I'm smoking, and I'm like trying to get that last little bit in. I remember I got home, and my mom's just crying. My mom's a wonderful person. She said, "You just need to go get help. Just go get help." And I went up to rehab in Clearbrook, and I was the happiest person in the world. But it didn't stick. You know, I had a great time up there. I got it. I remember before I left, the counselor told me, "You're going to relapse." "What do you mean I'm going to relapse?" "You're going to relapse. You got way too much ego, way too much attitude. Oh, F you. I'm going to relapse." Mm-hmm. Well, lo and behold, guess what? I'm right back out there relapsing. And what happened was, I remember I was coming up on my 90 days. In AA, that's a big celebration, 90 right. days. My family's excited. Everyone's pumped. I'm doing well. And I said to myself right before my 90 days, you know what? I need to go back to Atlanta because I have unfinished business there. My house is still – first of all, I had no concern while my mom and my family would pay rent. They'd move my stuff. I never had to step back in Atlanta. But I had every justification in the world as to why I had to go back to Atlanta. Got to tie up some loose ends. I got to pack my stuff. I got to see so-and-so. Subconsciously, there's one reason I want to go back to Atlanta. I want to go use drugs again.
I'm really doing well. I need to self-destruct.
That's right. I needed to go. And I remember, in fact, you know, my buddy who's sitting right here watching us, listening with us, he called me from the airport. "What the F are you doing going back to Atlanta? What the F? oh, don't worry about it. I'm fine. I got a few months in. The first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to go to a meeting. You don't worry about it. I'm fine. And I was only supposed to go back for a week or two, just take care of some stuff. When that plane landed in Atlanta, no exaggeration, I started to shake because I knew. So I didn't know consciously, I wouldn't say, but I knew subconsciously I was going to use again. And I got back to my place, and my room was just like I left it the day when I went to rehab. And it was like a crime scene. And there's vials, and there's, residue. And I remember I picked up some crack that I found there. First of all, a common person, if I was sober, wouldn't be back in Atlanta, or said, hey, you can get a cleaning person to clean my house and get rid of everything, not just leave it, because I knew I could go back there. And I remember saying, you want to know, I remember saying goodbye to my 90 days. I said goodbye 90 days, and with a flame, boom.
That was it. We'll tell you what happened next on Stepping Out. We'll be right back.
Welcome back one more time to Stepping Out. Scott Clark with you. Thanks for joining us. We've been hearing the trials and tribulations of Alex and his addictions and where they took him. 90 days of sobriety and then back to Atlanta, and you were back at it again. And what happened then, Alex?
Yeah, up in smoke, So I come back to New Jersey. I'm getting ready to celebrate my 90 days. My sponsor says, he had known. I could tell I relapsed. Hey, we don't have to celebrate. We can celebrate another month. But this is where the ego. Now I want to celebrate. So I get in front of all these, my A home group, A's, my family, I love it. And I had relapsed. I'm celebrating 90 days. I had relapsed. And I couldn't.
Lying through your teeth.
Yeah, and I couldn't, because you know what? I didn't want to admit yet that I really have a problem. And I remember I couldn't wait to get out of that meeting because I wanted to go get my drugs. That went on a few more months. Now I'm living at home. I'm in my 30s living at home. I'm stealing from my mother, and she's allowing me. Threatening this and that, but I knew I can get away with it. There was real no consequences. I think she never really wanted to give up me. I was working one day a week at CBS and some other place. I couldn't even keep that up. I was doing drugs at CBS part-time. I'm taking stuff into the bathroom. I was a mess. I remember finally I'd been for 4 or 5 days and I was coming home from CBS. I had no money, cause I'd used it all on drugs and everything. I'm running out of gas. And I get a flat tire at a gas station here in New York. And instead of crying, I just said, you want to know what? It's over. And this warmth came over me. It's over. And I'm done. And I said to my uncle, I said, can you get me in one more place? He's like, I'm running out of rehabs, because I'd been in another one in between there. And he got me in this another outpatient program. And you know what? It started from there, man. I started to get the gift of recovery.
And what has it been like since March 2005, was your last drug.
Yep.
Your last drink.
And it was fake drugs, by the way, I was smoking. I didn't care. The guy sold me fake drugs. I was smoking it. So
what's it been like in your 4 years of being clean and sober?
You know what? It's been absolutely phenomenal, to have the tools. As my uncle said, it's one of the best diseases to have, because not only can you get better, but you have the ability to improve your life. Not only can you beat the disease, but you have an ability to improve your life and to help others. And you know what? I used to be real self-conscious. I don't want to tell people, you're talking about stigma, tell people I'm an alcoholic or I'm in this. My aunt said something. Why should you be embarrassed? You're turning around your life. You should be proud of that. And once I got with that concept, and that's why I love AA, NA, whatever, they're all good for me, is people just trying to improve their lives and to help others. That's contagious. You know what? Life is so much easier today. It's unbelievable. I have awareness, my spirituality. I went to Catholic school my whole life. You know what? At the end, when I got sober, I didn't even know how to get back on my hands and knees to say prayers. And when I did it, there was like that connection again.
It has been a wonderful time with you. Thank you for the story. Thank you for telling us your trials and tribulations and your recovery. And Alex, we thank you so much on Stepping Out. I'm Scott Clark. We'll see you next time, one day at a time.